don't know what to say, really. 3 minutes to the biggest battle of our professional lives. All comes down to today. Either we heal as a team, or we're gonna crumble. Inch by inch, play by play, till we're finished. We're in hell right now, gentlemen. Believe me. And we can stay here, get the shit kicked out of us, or we can fight our way back into the light. We can climb out of hell. 1 inch at a time. Now, I can't do it for you. I'm too old. I look around, I see these young faces, and I think, I mean, I made every wrong choice a middle-aged man can make. I pissed away all my money, believe it or not. I chased off anyone who's ever loved me. And lately, I can't even stand the face I see in a mirror. You know, when you get old in life, things get taken from you. I mean, that's part of life. But you only learn that when you start losing stuff. You find out life's this game of inches. So is football. Because in either game, life or football, the margin for error is so small. I mean, one half a step too late or too early, and you don't quite make it. One half second too slow, too fast, you don't quite catch it. The inches we need are everywhere around us. They're in every break of the game, every minute, every second. On this team, we fight for that inch. On this team, we tear ourselves and everyone else around us to pieces for that inch. We claw with our fingernails for that inch. Because we know when we add up all those inches, that's gonna make the fucking difference between winning and losing. Between living and dying. I'll tell you this, in any fight, it's the guy who's willing to die who's gonna win that itch. And I know if I'm gonna have any life anymore, it's because I'm still willing to fight and die for that itch. Because that's what living is. The 6 inches in front of your face. Now I can't make you do it. You gotta look at the guy next to you. Look into his eyes. Now I think you're gonna see a guy who will go that inch with you.
Hell yeah.
You're gonna see a guy who will sacrifice himself for this team because he knows when it comes down to it, you're gonna do the same for him. That's a team, gentlemen. And either we heal now as a team, or we will die as individuals.
Hey, Steve.
That's football, guys.
I'm in the middle of recording important comments.
That's right.
That's all it is.
It's the recording part, so
now,
shut up. So love your talking.
What are you gonna do?
Can you believe that? Wow. Hey there, it's Dave Weiner. It's Morning Coffee Notes. It's a evening Morning Coffee Notes. Adam Curry says that the best Morning Coffee Notes are the evening, the early evening Morning Coffee Notes. He might be right. Let's savor this. Anyway, that was Al Pacino from the great, one of the, if not the greatest movie ever, called Any Given Sunday. It's, I always, when I first saw it, I told my friend, I saw it once, I saw it twice, saw it three times. And I'm not a big football fan. It's all, you know, it's a, it, the title, Any Given Sunday, means it's part, it's another Al Pacino speech in there. He says, basically, on any given Sunday, you could win or you could lose. It's sort of a toss-up. It's not how, it's not whether the game, it isn't whether you win or whether you lose, but it's that very sort of working together feeling. And that little speech, I'm a real sucker for it. I was actually looking for, I was going to play something different. I was going to play Bruce Springsteen, Blinded by the Light. But I came across that, and for one reason or another, I thought, today's the day. Let's put that one on and see what happens. And it chokes me up. I mean, and it's, I've heard, it, this is a guy thing, by the way. It's, I don't think that this has the same effect. I think that we're built differently, and that there, you know, if you say to a woman that's about love, what Al Pacino's talking about, they go, "You're kidding! I mean, that's not love. He's talking about beating the shit out of somebody." But that's not what he's talking about, really. It's not the beating the shit out of. It's not the beating the shit out of that's important, but it's the, you know, I'm willing to die for the team. And this is something genetic. It's not something that you think through and say, I think this is a smart thing for me to feel. Instead, it's just sort of, it cuts through all that thinking, and it's much deeper than that. And I think that's why it feels so good. I think that, you know, it's a survival of the fittest thing, maybe, that, you know, the human beings, especially the male human beings, who had this feeling that I'll go to battle with my brothers and we're, you know, we're going to, it's not whether we win or we lose. It's that we're willing to die for each other. That's the strong thing. Anyway, it's interesting because the third item on my list today, I have three items, and the third item relates to why part of it is about why people go to wars, why countries go to war, and and how it gets justified and the lunacy and the craziness of it. Because when you actually do go to war, you do have to think. It's not just about how you feel. The feelings are important, though. Anyway, three things. One is, the first is, hey, it's 10 years. 10 years ago today, I remember where I was. I was sitting in the office in the sort of den at the house, at my house in Woodside, California. And I was unemployed and was looking for something interesting to do. A friend had suggested, Sally Atkins had suggested that I look at this, at the internet, and I find out what the web is. And I had seen a demo and had thought it was kind of strange. I didn't understand it. I'd always had this sense that anything that lived on the network had to be this just huge thing. You know, a machine that, you know, a person like you or I, you know, we couldn't own one of those machines. And what I was learning was, is that the machines that make up this network called the internet, which I had actually heard of quite a while before, that the computers on that network were just like the computers that I used. In fact, they were, you know, the same sort of, you know, Dell desktop machines, except usually they were running, instead of running Windows, they were running some flavor of Unix. And So I had been studying HTTP and HTML and the email protocols and FTP and Telnet. And, of course, there really wasn't much to study. These are remarkably simple, transparent even, things. Easy to understand. And yet, miraculously, they worked incredibly well. I knew that AppleLink had a connection on the back end. AppleLink was the email system that I used and lots of other people used in 1994, in the software industry, that is. And I knew that they had a gateway that got you onto the internet, but by the time, so you could send, I could send an email to somebody at internet, and you know, and it would get to them. I just put the internet address in front and then @internet on the address line inside of AppleLink, and they could respond. And I just thought, this must be a lot of work, it must be really hard to do. And again, in that period of epiphany when I was studying the protocols, it seemed to me that it must not be very much. I hadn't actually done anything like that. I hadn't written any programs that do stuff like that. However, on October 7th, 1994, I did write a script. I put in all the email addresses that I had gotten off of business cards from going to conferences like Stuart Alsop's Esther Dyson's PC Forum, and Stuart's Agenda Conference and Demo Conference and Mac World Expos, and you know, it was heavily slanted. I was a Mac developer, had been for a few years, exclusively a Mac developer for 6 years, and had developed on the Mac for, well, actually 10 years. That was the 10th anniversary of the Macintosh, which, of course, this year must have been the 20th anniversary. I had this thought, well, okay, I have all these email addresses now. What would I do with these? And I said, I want to send them all an email. And so I sort of looked around, what could I send them an email about? And I said, oh, okay, Mark Kander is doing a rollout of his a new company, or a new product in a new company. And the product was called Meet the Media Band. And Mark was still quite rich at that point. He was spending his money at an incredible rate. And like a lot of people that knew Mark, I was concerned for him that, you know, that he'd be successful, because he was probably going to run out of money pretty soon at the rate he was spending it. And so I helped out there, but that wasn't kind of really what was going on. What was really going on, and I couldn't have told you all this, but I did figure it out within two Dave Nets, that I was sort of dipping my toe into this idea of publishing my own stuff and doing it. I mean, my own part was probably the essential thing, even though the first two pieces that I sent out were not my own stuff. They were about Mark's stuff. So shortly after sending out the second piece was a list of things the media didn't understand about multimedia that Mark had written, and that was part of the rollout. This was the aftermath of the rollout. Sort of like the first was the announcement, the second was a sort of a report. By the time the third piece came around, I was already thinking, okay, I could use this for some of my own ideas, not just other people's ideas. And I had talked with Jim Canavino, who was then the head of the PC division at IBM, and to John Sculley, who was the chairman and CEO of Apple Computer, and felt that they ought to work together, that between the two companies, they had this was 1994, that the Macintosh plus IBM, you know, and Apple would be a good challenger, good at least number two to Microsoft and Windows. And so I had written a piece about, they of course didn't do anything, they didn't even respond. And so I put that out as a piece, and then I had been looking at PDAs, and I you know, had some thoughts that a PDA was basically something that needed to be tethered to a desktop PC, and had more to say about it, but that was basically the idea. So I sent that piece out, and that got back a response from Randy Patat, who was an executive at Motorola who was in charge of their PDAs. And he said, no, that's silly. That's like saying that a personal computer would be tethered to a mainframe computer, that a PDA has, you know, just as much independence. I didn't think so, because the PDA didn't have a keyboard, so I didn't see how you're going to enter all the data into the PDA. I may have been short-sighted, but it certainly turned out to be true that the early PDAs did end up being tethered. Today, PDAs can... Randy was kind of right as far as today is concerned, but to get to where they are, because the kids know how to type on those little phone sort of dial pads, they can use that. An old fart like myself, well, you know, where's the keyboard, is what I said. And then epiphany time. There were a few other pieces in between. There was one about an open letter to Steve Ballmer and about, you know, why well, it's not even important. That wasn't a big piece. The two big pieces were entitled Bill Gates versus the Internet and Platform's Chinese Household. And I think of the two of them, well, I'd say they're both equally important, because the first one was saying that that was the real epiphany. It was that the internet had solved all the problems that the PC industry had failed to solve. The, you know, PC industry, not that it hadn't tried to solve those, but because of politics and you know, wanting companies wanting to control things and the way companies work, where there's very little incentive to make things easy and make them clonable, and quite the opposite, actually. Over-engineering and making things opaque and hard to clone, is there's a lot of rewards for doing that. So for years, the software industry had fought over email standards and integration standards like OpenDoc. Now the browser completely solved, the web browser completely solved the problem that OpenDoc was trying to solve, but did it in such an incredibly low-tech way that it wasn't immediately apparent to people in the software industry that they had solved the problem, partially because the software industry hadn't done a good enough job of saying what the problem was. And my point was basically, Bill Gates, you've been fighting the wrong battle, and your battle basically is irrelevant. You can keep fighting it if you want to, but winning will mean nothing. And so I wrote that, and I remember the hesitation at the moment of sending it, because sending out an email to, at that point, it was, you know, several hundred people, is both a powerful and sort of scary thing to do, because once it's out, there's no taking it back. It's gone, and if somebody gets angry at you, well, you know, this fear comes from childhood, I think, that having people angry at you was connected to your ability to survive. It was no longer true. I mean, Bill Gates could get as angry at me as he wanted, but it wasn't going to make the slightest bit of difference as to whether I survived or not. But you don't think about things that clearly as you're about to hit the send button. And so I did, and immediately got back some, I mean, very positive, you know, hey, wow, great piece type things, and felt pretty good. And I don't remember exactly how long it was before I got a response from Bill Gates himself. And it was a long, whiny sort of, I don't know, whiny may not be fair. You know, he didn't accept what, I guess to say that he didn't accept my point of view was an understatement. It was a very strongly stated, hey, the Microsoft attitude at that time was kind of whiny, you know, and it worked pretty well. It was kind of intimidating. But I read it, and as I was reading it, it dawned on me that despite whether he likes it or not, this is incredible. I just wrote a piece and published it, and virtually instantaneously, the subject of the piece writes back. So I sent it out. I basically took the email that he sent me and created something in the same format as the thing I had just sent out, and out it went to all the people who'd subscribed to my newsletter. And I think that for me and for a lot of other people, that was the moment. That was the big moment. That was when you realized how powerful this was, this way of publishing was. Because had I been writing for, you know, PC Magazine or PC Week or Mac Week or even Wired Magazine, the editorial process would have taken a while. It might not have dawned on anybody that Bill Gates' response itself was editorial quality. They might have put it in the letters to the editor, you know, which would have been a shame because in many ways his piece was more newsworthy than my piece was. I mean, this was Bill Gates was, you know, he was the top guy in the software industry at the time and a very, very, very powerful and rich person. And even from today's point of view, it still is kind of surprising, that whole little interchange. But it was in itself, there wasn't a whole lot more growing to do after that. Basically, you know, it was one person writing, one person responding, great theater, and led to the next piece, which was called Platform is Chinese Household, which was an element of Bill Gates's response was, you know, standard Microsoft fare is, you know, we worked our ass off to make the Macintosh a success, and what did they do? They sued us, you know, and no doubt that was heartfelt, and it's true that Microsoft did do everything to make the Mac successful, and without Microsoft, well, you know, probably wouldn't have been any productivity software, or wouldn't have been much productivity software. Maybe the machine wouldn't have made it, maybe Apple wouldn't have survived. One thing's for sure, if you took him at face value, he and I had a lot of the same issues with Apple. And this is going to go to item number two. It's my hatred ratio. this was the Apple he was talking about. Why don't we just go right into that? Just to say, close the last one off. 10 years, incredible. Let's have 10 more, you know. Those early Dave Nets led to lots of good stuff. Today we're doing audio blog posts or what we call podcasts, like the one you're listening to right now, and it's just as raw, just as new a medium as blogging was in 1990, whatever, whenever you want to say that it began. And raw is good, and there you have it. I said it. So probably get quoted on that. Maybe somebody will do a mixtape on that. Raw, raw, raw is good, says Dave. Anyway, I was down at Microsoft, of all places, today, hanging out with Scoble in the hallway there, and one of his colleagues was noting, he was saying, you know, it's really weird, but, you know, nobody seems to hate Apple. And I thought about it. He says, you know, you're right. You know, well, why is that? And immediately, I thought about it. Well, I think I've been getting to understand this. This is something that I wrote a few months ago when I had an epiphany as to why people were hating Google. And actually, it was about a year ago. I remember I was writing with Chris Lydon on our way back from New Hampshire to some campaign event in the presidential primary campaign. And I said, you know, I understand why people hate Google, because I was experiencing this myself. And I explained it as follows, that I feel like I was instrumental in their success. I felt like I was part of their success, that in my own way I had helped to create their success. And because of that, I feel that they have a debt to me. They have a responsibility to me to use that success in the way that I feel that they should use it. And but this is largely an unconscious feeling, if, you know, until that moment I hadn't even realized that I had that expectation. But I did. It was very, very true that I did. And the reason, and what is hate? Hate is betrayal. It's betrayed love. And I feel that they've betrayed that expectation that I have, that I feel that they should do something in particular, like be good to the web, and particularly be good to RSS, because RSS is, as I see it, in every way, one of the best things to come out of the web ever. And they betray that expectation. On the other hand, now I understand why some people hate me. Again, because they feel that they were with me and they helped me, that my success, to the extent that I am successful, that they are responsible for my success to some extent, and that when I don't honor their expectations for me, that I've betrayed them, and betrayal is hate. Betrayal plus love equals hate, so they hate me. And I said at the time that, I understand that how, in some sense, how it must feel to be at Google, because where what I get is coffee cup size hate, and they get carload size hate. And then, of course, Microsoft, and this goes back to what Scoble's colleague and I were talking about, that Microsoft gets, semi-trailer truck sized or, rocket ship sized hatred. And I was wondering today, could there be a mathematical formula for expressing this? And I said, aha, I got it. So here's how it works. Okay, this is the second step in explaining this phenomenon. It's a ratio, and in the numerator is success. So the more success you have, there is a tendency for people to hate you that much. But in the denominator, so this is the division, what you divide by, is your humility. So success divided by humility equals hatred, how much people hate you. So the answer is, now Apple is quite successful, and it's be hard to argue today that relative to most people, look at Steve Jobs. He's a billionaire. How many times over do you have to be a billionaire before, you get this, where people call you a success? 1 billion versus 40 billion. Does that really make a difference? And I think Jobs is worth well more than a billion. He was worth a billion when he came back to Apple. He must be worth much more than that now. But so you take his success. He's certainly quite successful, but why don't we hate him? And the answer is he's humble. If you watch him, he's not my kind of guy. I see Jobs as being somebody who, when he was a kid, would raise his hand, "Teacher, teacher, call on me," and the teacher would call on him, and he would say, "Oh, teacher, you are the best teacher in the world. Have I ever told you that?" And all the kids in the class would go, "Rah," and the teacher would go, "Oh, Steve, I wish all the kids were like you." And of course, after school, you'd beat the crap out of him. not really, but you'd hate his guts anyway. So to me, Steve Jobs, and I think that people who work at Microsoft are kind of like this. They don't understand why somebody might like that personality, but people do. And so it's seen as humility. He stands up there on stage and says, and asks, "Would you like to see another feature before I leave? Oh, I forgot. We have another feature. Would you like to see it?" Now, does anybody believe that he really forgot? Come on. How many times do they have to play that trick on you before you get it? He's not, didn't forget. It's just the way this sort of he does it. why don't you just tell me what it is? And you know what? Put the big feature first, because I'm kind of busy. But that's not Steve Jobs. But it works, and I think a lot of people see it as humility. And so if you take the success and you divide it by the humility, you end up with a reasonable number, and people don't hate Apple, but they do hate Microsoft because Bill Gates isn't very humble. He certainly is quite successful, but the more success he gets, it is not, you don't divide it by any reasonable amount of humility. Now, if Bill Gates were to get up, and I know this isn't going to happen, okay? But if he were to get up, or let's say he bought some TV time, and he sat down in front of the camera and he said, "Hello, I'm Bill Gates, And I, first of all, would like to tell you how I screwed up personally. I never should have tried to take over the browser market, Netscape. I shouldn't have tried to kill Netscape. I'm really sorry. We really wish we hadn't done all those things. And, you know, if you can find it in your heart to forgive us, we'll go on and we'll do really good things. Like, we'll make an identity system and we'll put in all kinds of safeguards to make sure that your data is safe. And we'll hire these watchdogs to look over our shoulders. And at the first sign of impropriety, they'll tell you. But that isn't really why I'm on TV today. I'm here basically just to ask you to forgive us for having been such jerks. We didn't know. Our only excuse is we just didn't get how much of jerks we were being at the time. So we're sorry. I'm sorry. Deepest regrets. I wish we could do something to take it back. Yours truly, Bill Gates. You know what would happen? As strange as it sounds, as weird and unrealistic as it sounds, the hatred would sort of dry up. People wouldn't hate. How can you hate a guy who gets on TV and says he's sorry? You have to come back and say, look, what else could he do? You know, it may sound unintuitive, but that's my guess, is that it would be one hell of a thing to do, both for Microsoft and for Bill Gates. But anyway, you hold your breath. I don't think it's going to happen. Anyway, so last item, and this is something, this is a kind of a subtle idea, but it's an important one. And this is the thing that John Kerry can't say, you know, because if you could peer inside of his soul, you know, George Bush taunted him. He said, you know, this guy's never told us what he wants to do in Iraq, what his great plan is, what his great idea is. And to this day, it's true. He hasn't told us. But he started to tell us, and then all of a sudden George Bush said, criticized him for the things that he was saying. And I knew that this was going to come up because, you know, I know, and I think everybody else knows, that Kerry can't tell us what he's going to do. Because to tell us what he's going to do would be to completely subvert what he's going to do. And he's, if anything, is a responsible person. And I think that's why his numbers are going up, because we all kind of get it, that Kerry is being responsible. And the other thing, that if you're really paying attention, you can see how irresponsible President Bush is being and has been. So let's go back to what the issue is, what my issue is with Bush, and I think what everybody else's issue with him should be. Okay? And, you know, remember Colin Powell at the UN in the winter of 2003, in like January of 2003. Maybe it was December 2002. We'd have to go back and look. But it was the tapes of the Iraqis talking. It was the evidence of them playing monkey business on the weapons of mass destruction. So people say, well, you know, George was just as fooled. He saw the same evidence that we did. And I got to say, oh, really? Didn't George Bush create that evidence? I mean, that's the difference between us and everybody else. We had to ask, would they invent this? We said, nah, Colin Powell, you know, he may be a lot of things, but he's not a liar, you know. George Bush, yeah, he kind of looks like a liar, but he sent Colin Powell there, you know. And I think that Colin Powell wouldn't be lying for him. So I'd love to know how they got Colin Powell to do that. And I think that Colin Powell should come clean and explain. I think he's got to come clean and explain right now, before this election, how that happened. And how it happened that he was there at the United Nations on television. Because to me, that was the moment. That was the moment I decided, I think we don't have a choice. We have to trust these guys. And I think that was the moment when they totally didn't deserve the trust. And they were lying. So this idea that you hear from the Republicans these days, which is that, yeah, they, you know, we all had the same information. We all came to the same conclusion. You can't blame George Bush for that. No, we got the information from George Bush. If the information was inaccurate, you're damn straight we can blame him for it. In fact, we have to blame him for it. If we go ahead and reelect him, knowing that, I mean, okay, they all lie. All right, I accept that. You know, I had a hard time with Clinton and his lies. And, you know, I want to tell you, I supported his impeachment and his removal from office because he lied to us. And, you know, if you get caught lying to your boss and you do it in a really disrespectful way, your boss fires your ass. I mean, that's it. You go, right? And God, if we aren't his boss, we were Clinton's boss and we're Bush's boss too. That's how it works in this country. They work for us. And we're responsible for them. Every 4 years, you know, a president has to run for re-election. After 4 years, we get to throw him out. In fact, we can throw him out before 4 years if he's bad enough. And that's what the whole Clinton thing was about. Well, this guy Bush, you know, they say when Clinton lied, nobody died. It's true. Nobody did die when Clinton lied. When Bush lied, lots of people died. We didn't need to go to war in Iraq. Had we known that the reason for going to war was trumped up, we never would have gone to war in Iraq. He knew that, and that's why he lied to us. He knew that he couldn't do this war if he had told us the truth, that we really, really, really don't know for a fact that this guy has weapons of mass destruction. That was the truth. Maybe it's worse than that, but it's at least that bad. Instead, we were told with certainty that they do have them. And we all did the right thing, including Kerry and Edwards. And this is what, I can't believe they ding them for this. Because, you know, if I were Kerry, I'd say, you're really criticizing me for supporting you? For deciding that we had no choice but to trust the commander-in-chief? Are you really, really going to ding me for that, Mr. President? You know, and that's because right along with John Kerry, he's doing it to me too. He's saying, Dave, you supported this war. You voted for it. I had my doubts, and I would not have voted for this war. And I actually, of course, never was given a vote for the war. But I never would have supported it had I known that Colin Powell's presentation was a lie. I decided that they knew, they told me that they knew that they had weapons of mass destruction. And I know how that works. And so I said, they think this is serious. They think he's got nukes. They think he's going to use them. These can't be crazy people. You know, the president can't be crazy. In other words, if he says we have to go to war because these guys are about to use their nuclear weapons, okay, let's do it. Now, to find out later that this was all fabricated says only one thing to me, that we deserve what we get if we reelect this guy. So today, the rhetoric from Bush is that you can't have a guy who says, wrong war, wrong time, wrong place. This is his favorite quote. And you can't elect him commander-in-chief because he can't build an alliance or he can't work with the Frances and the Germanys. And by the way, his good friend, Vladimir, Russia, Vladimir Putin, was right up there with Russia, with France and Germany in not supporting the war. That, you know, Kerry and China, by the way, China and India and, you know, these are some big countries that have a lot of resources that all did not come with us in Iraq. So this will carry, if you say wrong war, wrong place, wrong time, how can you go to them and then ask them to help? And the answer to that is, and that's a little sleight of hand, okay? That's assuming we don't think about this. But listen carefully. He can't ask them for help if he doesn't say that. Why? Because they know it was wrong war, wrong time, wrong place. It's obvious. Anybody with a mind knows that. So if your answer is to stand up there and keep repeating a lie, thinking somehow they'll be shamed into supporting you, keep dreaming. You're going to lose all the support you've got. Not only will you lose all the support that you've got from the few remaining, you know, coalition of the willings, not only will you lose all the support from them, but you already have lost the support of the American people. I mean, I'd love to see a poll that asks how many people think that our reasons for going to war in Iraq were the actual reasons for why we went to war in Iraq. You know, when a president lies to you about why he's taking you to war, I don't really think there's anything worse than that. And if you reelect him, he's going to do it again. And as Rogers Caden had pointed out, you know, that's sort of the superficial first order result of looking at the situation. But and on second look, nobody's going to believe him. Next time the guy goes out screaming, we've got to go in and take out the leader of this country because they're screwing us hard and we're going to end up with nukes in downtown Manhattan, everybody's going to go, oh, there he goes. We heard that before. Come on. You can't. There's no problem. Yeah, what if it's for real next time? What if next time we really do, it is that situation where, you know, it's 11:59 p.m., the guy's about to send the suitcase, detonate the suitcase bomb in you know, in the middle of Chicago or Los Angeles, London, New York, Miami, San Francisco, Seattle, maybe all of them at the same time, Beijing, Manila, Sydney, maybe all those cities. Let's go rural. Let's get rid of the Western world. One day, boom. You know, is it foreseeable? It could happen. Will we have a warning system if Bush isn't president? Absolutely not. He has no credibility. He can't be trusted. So there we go. That's the. And are we back to arguing? You know, when Bush says Kerry can't, that the perception is that Kerry. I mean, there we are. Perception again. That Kerry, by telling the truth, that Kerry is being irresponsible by telling the truth. What Bush is saying is that it's okay to play the what is means game, if you can even say it. Remember Clinton looking into the camera saying, that depends on what is means. In fact, he couldn't even say it. It was such a convoluted thought. But that's what Bush is saying. Bush is saying, if Kerry doesn't lie, he doesn't love us. And I say, if we vote for Bush after, number one, him lying on such an important issue, and number two, years later, still not getting it, we deserve what we get. So, anyway, 10 years of DaveNet. Happy October 7th, everybody. It's got to, there's nowhere but up from here. Have a great day. Talk to you later. Bye.